It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 123 for Friday, the 10th of May, 2013. This week, we're discussing women. Specifically, the study that has suggested women undervalue themselves when working alongside men. Plus, how would you like some auto-playing video advertisements in your Facebook newsfeed? We ask, because it looks like they're coming. Plus, an artist has taken DNA from discarded fingernails and used it to 3D print the owner's face. Seriously. All that and more shall be explained as we go Clarissa on this week's Wired News. Ahoy hoy, Nate Langston here. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, Liat Clark.
Hello.
And Ian Steadman.
Hello.
Now, we have no Liv this week because she's feeling a little hoarse. Not literally, I hasten to add.
She has a particularly sexy voice today.
She is. She has some sort of throat error that's preventing her words.
Preventing her from speaking.
Her body is debugging it as we speak.
It's interesting hearing her do interviews on the phone.
It is. So you're stuck with just me and sans Liv this week, but she will be taking care of the edit. So she will have her healthy hooves involved in this week's show. Let's get on with some news, shall we? This week we had a rather controversial story in that Facebook is pondering including video ads in your news feed. This is according to a report that was published on the FT this week. And the strategy is likely to launch in July, we understand, and features video ads that are distributed across the user's news feed, I suppose down the user's news feed, as is currently the case with like suggested posts and suggested mobile app installs on mobile apps. And the first video to appear in this stream will autoplay, although I should point out it's been noted without sound.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Now, if successful, sources have said that this integration of video ads could boost Facebook's revenue by about £1 million a day. However, what use is an ad if your audience leaves because they think that your ads suck?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Nothing I hate more than a page that autoplays an ad as
Me
soon
too.
As you go onto
and
it.
And you have to find out where it's coming from so you can pause it. At least they don't have the sound.
Yeah, that is a good thing because I think we've all had that thing where you have lots of tabs open and then suddenly something starts playing and you have no idea where it is.
And you just start hunting around for the annoying man yelling at you about car insurance.
Correct. Now, I imagine that Facebook will be doing a significant amount of A-B testing to work out what is the best implementation, what's the least annoying, because obviously they don't want their users to leave. And I think that this is the next obvious step for Facebook in terms of trying to get money out of its users. I mean, it's actually starting to do quite well now. And, you know, the majority of Facebook's users now are mobile. So there are more people who use Facebook on mobile devices than use it on a desktop now. And so, you know, if video is, you know, can be part of that, then it needs to be done in an extremely smart way because there's so much less screen real estate.
Well, also data downloads. Like, I mean, if you're on a plan that doesn't give you a lot of data to download, that's going to eat up your data allowance having lots of videos automatically downloading.
Leah?
Well, it's just it's painful when you're on the mobile anyway and you're looking at mobile as taking up, you know, you have to scroll and scroll to get to anything remotely interesting. I can't even imagine video in my face.
Well, we've seen this on YouTube where YouTube has been using pre-rolls and so videos can be skipped or ads can be skipped after 5 seconds to get to a video, and so those first 5 seconds have to be absolutely fantastic from an ads creation perspective, but they're still very annoying. You land on a YouTube video and it's like, even 5 seconds,
you're
it's
just
like
sitting there going click 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 click.
Have any of us ever, I know I haven't, have you ever watched one of those ads past the 5 second mark?
Never.
I have watched a few from not the entire way through, I don't think, but certainly I've been intrigued, and that's good. I mean, I don't think anyone really minds ads if they're actually relevant or interesting, non-intrusive. Like if they complement what you're doing, then I think that's fine.
Absolutely. My Facebook ads thus far have been painfully irrelevant.
I almost bought a sofa from a Facebook ad. Almost. I stressed the almost. I actually went to see it in real life and I didn't like it, but it was very relevant.
So here's something I want to throw out there. It's also been reported that YouTube is going to start launching paid channels as early as this month. So if you have a channel, for example, Wired or any of these video networks that produce lots of different shows, you might be able to pay a subscription that might only be a couple of pounds a month to that channel in order to get things like exclusive content or early access to the videos or what have you. And it makes me wonder that if that's the direction YouTube is going or thinks that the market would like to follow it down that road, this is not a great sentence, but you know what I'm saying, then perhaps the next step for Facebook, if it does like these videos, could be pay to disable video ads.
Wow.
And you could have an ad-free Facebook by paying to opt out. I mean, a lot of sites do that. You know, there are lots of sites you can subscribe to and it will remove the ads.
What about, isn't there a company that's just started up this week and they're doing what Facebook began doing, just the university social networking?
Makes really? Sense.
Have you seen this? Yeah.
So I haven't seen it.
We're going to start to fill the gaps where if people leave Facebook for the videos. I'm not going to pay.
Well, this could launch as soon as July. So let us know what you think. Facebook.com/WiredUK. What better place to give us feedback about Facebook than Facebook? Liat, story the second. Glowing trees could pave the way for solving world problems with biology. Not even a remotely... provocative title there.
I love these guys. These are guys behind a Kickstarter project that basically wants to grow glowing plants, and it has smashed its target this week, like by a ridiculous amount. They've got 28 days to go, and they've already got $270,000.
What was the original?
About 65,000. It's like quadruple the original target.
Amazeballs.
And they are pretty chuffed, as you might imagine. I spoke with the synthetic biologist behind the design, Omri Amiravdrori, if I said his name right, who's one third of the team, and he's basically super excited. He wants to get kids excited about science and the possibilities of biology, and it looks like they're really on the right track. They've kind of hit on something that's, you know, obviously quite compelling to read about, but it's more kind of the wider story of what can be done with synthetic biology is what they want to get across.
All right, I have two questions, because I'm not familiar with the story really that much. Firstly, what is the benefit of a glowing plant? And secondly, how are they doing it?
Well, wouldn't it be great, you know? I mean, from his point of view, he was saying that the idea came about, he's walking around tree-lined roads. What if our roads could all be lit from trees? What if we could grow our own light resources and energy resources?
So a tree could replace a light street lamp?
Possibly one day. I mean, already there have been experiments to make a tobacco plant grow successfully. I mean, this is not going to light up a street. I think one team actually managed, and I think it was Cambridge, actually managed to make the plant grow bright enough that you could read a book by it.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool.
That's very bright.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they might be like right next to the book, but, you know, in the light. But and the way they're doing it, actually, it's the company that this guy Omri owns as well, called Genome Compiler, makes software that allows you to modify DNA sequence and debug it and basically play around with DNA sequence. And they are taking an enzyme that makes fireflies glow and inserting it into a chunk of DNA from the Arabidopsis plant. Yes.
Spoken like a true layman.
All right. You say it. And so then the sequence is sent off to a lab to be printed, and they insert it into the plant. That's what they're doing, the prototypes, and eventually they'll be able to grow seeds. And people who actually fund the project are all getting sent seeds, which has irked quite a few people, a few environmental groups, like Friends of the Earth, have got concerns about people, you know, planting glowing plants all over the place and they're going to destroy crops or something. But the team have said that they're using a specifically low risk plant that has a very low risk of spreading in the wild. So that's how they...
Now, we have a lot of these sort of DIY hacking and biohacking labs around now. Would this mean that with their technology, I could go down to my local DIY biohacking laboratory and 3D print a glowing plant to read by?
Absolutely. One day, if it took your fancy. I mean, that is like, really, you've hit on their point. They're saying, you know, you can crowdsource DNA sequences, we can crowdfund it. They're using a local community DIY lab to do it. They're completely, you know, the academic route. I mean, he said he's had academic papers published before and it takes forever and then it's peer reviewed at the end. The way they do it here, it's kind of peer reviewed all the way through. It's completely open source. You can download the DNA sequences as they go through. You can see how they tweak it and change it. That extra money is going to give them that opportunity to keep kind of playing around with the sequence and keep growing these plants, because they only take like 3 months. They've got a 3 month life cycle, so they can, you know, keep continually improving it until, yes, you can go down your lab and
if you're going out to the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. The trees are glowing.
Amazing.
They didn't write about that in the poetry books.
No, they did not. And they should. Books. Get the kids excited about science, man. That's what they should be doing.
This is excellent. I look forward to my dahlias bursting with the light of a genetically modified innard.
Well, apparently they're going to do a rose next, so yeah. Maybe daily is next.
Interesting.
You're already listening to the Wired.co.uk podcast, but you might have a friend who is less fortunate. Why not send them a postcard with wired.co.uk/podcast written on the back so they can join in?
Let's transition to Wikipedia. Ian, this week, page views could predict stock market changes. Now, it sounds like a dry story, but the data here is actually very compelling, and that's what got me interested in this piece.
It is. This is a study in the journal Scientific Reports from Warwick Business School. A team there was looking at Wikipedia from 2007 to 2012 and correlating it with the Dow Jones Industrial Average stock index. You know, so far, so dry.
Yeah.
But what they found was very clearly there was this trend that the greater the... if you had a week where there was a greater than average number of views of a page relative to the average...
Like a company page.
Yeah, something like that. That would be followed very regularly by a drop in that company's share price. Huh. Very predictably. And the implication was that Wikipedia pages, you know, they're very useful for people researching stuff. They're also useful for people who invest in shares. And so that an increase in the number of people who are researching a company, it reflects a great number of people wanting to sort of get involved in shares and stuff. As to why it's always a drop rather than a rise, the researchers suggested that it's, they don't know, but they suggest that it's basically because humans are naturally risk averse. So the idea is that the more you know about a risky proposition, the less likely you are to invest in it.
But you could manipulate a stock drop in order to buy that stock.
Absolutely.
And this raises some interesting questions. And my first thought was, we've seen a lot of uses for botnets.
Mm.
And botnets that DDoS and send huge amounts of traffic to particular websites and servers. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot. Now, it makes me wonder, you could hire a botnet for a few quid to attack a Wikipedia page of a company whose stock is seen as very valuable, perhaps Apple or Microsoft or ExxonMobil, those sorts of things, and visit their page so that it causes a drop in the stock price.
Would that work, though? Is it not?
I mean, that would work if people are using analysis.
Yeah, that would work if it was if the Wikipedia page was causing the stock drop. But not if it's a reflection of people's research into the company, but. If you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm trying to think if that is something that would work.
You could do something similar to that, which is something the researchers actually looked into.
If they're monitoring the number of page views that it has.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That would work. Yeah,
that's what I think.
And they actually tested that in a way. They devised to kind of test their hypothesis and see if it kind of always worked. They looked at historical data and applied a random investment model to it, and also an investment model that relied on the Wikipedia information. And they found that they would have had profits 141% higher if they'd had a model that had taken account of Wikipedia information.
Bam.
And if you'd restricted it to just macroeconomics and capital finance pages, it would have given you 297% higher profit, which is incredible.
Yeah, but like Nate says, if people actually start using it, it's going to be massively open.
Oh, yeah. It's a kind of an arms race, isn't it? It's one person gets it and everyone gets it and stuff like that. So I imagine, you know, we're not too far from the next high-frequency trading broker putting it in their algorithm and...
Bitcoins and Wikipedia, the future of finance.
Yes.
Frightening. Liv, you're not Liv.
I'm Liat.
Liv is upstairs, being quiet. Liat, in fact. Tell me about this study about 3D printing a working invisibility cloak.
Yeah.
This is totes amaze.
I just feel like I need to say immediately that it's not going to make you invisible. Just
Why?
In case you think you're going to like run out and go and buy a makeup bot. And become invisible.
I'd love to do that.
One day.
I actually have a goal for what would happen if I could be invisible, which is to walk in front of people who are looking at their phones invisibly and then go visible again and have them walk into me and look at the confusion on their face. It's like, oh, sorry.
There's so much cooler stuff you could do
I'd
than
love
that.
To do I'd absolutely love to do that. Anyway, I'm digression. Tell me the news.
Yeah, so basically, this is a group at Duke University for quite a few years now. Researchers at Duke University have been developing different versions of metamaterial invisibility cloaks, and these have so far been made of things like fiberglass and copper, and they've used one recently with copper tape that made it kind of more flexible and easy to use, but these deflect microwaves around objects. We cannot yet deflect visible light effectively, but now they're suggesting, let's just 3D print them, man, and open this up to everyone.
Word.
Yeah, so they 3D printed them from polymer. It's basically the way they do this, like the modulations in the surface are smaller than the wavelength of light, and they're arranged in such a way that microwaves can travel around an object and they're radiated into free space. So the object in the center, like for instance, that the device they've 3D printed is cylindrical, it's kind of like a frisbee with a hole in the middle. So you can put an object in the center, and when they tested it out, it appeared as if it was invisible. So obviously this kind of technology is more appropriate for radar and things like that.
So that's perfectly suited to 3D printing.
Not scaring people. Exactly, yes, because 3D printing, you can obviously kind of work out, you've got algorithms to work out exactly how these modulations on the surface should go, and you just put in your CAD file and bam, 4 to 7 hours you've got yourself.
Really makes me think, like, 3D printing, what can't it do?
So this was, well, this was lots of things. Although the first 3D printed gun was fired successfully.
It was, yes.
Yeah, that is
We're not talking about that today.
Yeah, but that's a big...
As a bonus bit of news. So this was a study. Was it successful? Did it work?
Yeah, it was absolutely successful. It was so successful. They said they actually think the technique would be appropriate for higher frequency radiation, even invisible light.
Wow.
The holy grail of invisibility cloaks.
Plus, I guess if you can buy a 3D printer for like £1,000,
yeah,
1500,
exactly, pounds. And they're getting cheaper. There's like, I think someone's come out with one that's half the price of MakerBot. I think it's only in the US at Staples, but you know, it's coming to a 3D printer near you.
Excellent. Well, we're coming to an ad break, but when we come back, we're going to dive into a rather controversial emerging problem of the world, which is that of in-app purchases and kids running up huge bills on huge, expensive, non-existent donuts.
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Welcome back. This is our first segment. Second time this one's appeared, I think. Order, order. Now, we have talked quite a bit in the past about apps and mobile payments, and there is a real issue at the moment, and it's great news for the tabloids and fear-mongering papers of the world, that children are being given iPads and phones and Android tablets and stuff with free games on it, but because the account information is stored on that tablet and these games offer in-app payments, things like get extra lives or buy extra costumes for your character, things like that, that kids are inadvertently being given access to your bank account and are not taking into it or not aware of the fact that these purchases are actually real money. And we've seen a lot of cases where kids have run up huge bills, and it actually at one point led to a class action lawsuit settlement in the US, which saw Apple agreeing to refund these costs that have been racked up by some of these games, some of them called bait games, basically those sorts of free apps where you download free, but you know, you buy a mammoth and then you buy a bigger mammoth and then you buy a bigger mammoth pen and suddenly you've spent £500. There was also a case that we reported on recently, and a lot of other people did too, where a child managed to spend £1,000 on virtual donuts for Homer in the Simpsons Tapped Out game. It's a real problem, and Apple is pretty good at judging these on a case-by-case basis and refunding where necessary, because obviously there's no real monetary loss to somebody, you know, for buying something fake, so they're able to refund quite easily without loss to the developer. But a study has come out this week that suggests that £30 million are being added to the UK phone bill world every year as a result of these in-app payments. 30 million of rogue in-app payments. That's a frighteningly high
and
number.
And that's probably why it's so easy to buy them for kids, because they make a lot of money off it. The incentive there is for the app makers to make it so that a kid can just click a button and they've spent £5.
And they make it look like a nice little cartoon fake money thing that you click on. I think that the average purchase is obviously like much lower than these kind of £1,000 stories. It's like £20, but I mean, a parent would be pretty peeved. You got £20-30 extra on your bill a month.
So I mean, the typical way that this has worked is buying in-game coins. Games are free to download, but you might want to buy some new costumes for your character, and you earn coins by playing the game. But if you want to get there, if you want to get those costumes or that level or that new racetrack or car, whatever, faster, you can pay, you know, 69p for a bag of coins or £1.50 for a case of coins. And that goes up often to about £70 for, you know, often hundreds of thousands of these in-game coins to basically just speed up the acquisition of in-game items. And it's a business model that a lot of companies are really betting on, you know, right up to the sizes of EA. You know, they really are betting the future of some of their games on free-to-play with in-app purchases. Tapped Out is a great example because it's a really good game. It's a lot of fun. But yeah, you're basically doing stuff in the game by having these donuts. And if you want donuts faster, then spend some money.
Yeah, but people are going to push back against this, like we're seeing now already. There's more and more stories. I mean, when I see, like, my nephew, by the time he was one, was sitting there playing with an iPad, just playing games by himself. It's astonishing to watch him. Yeah. And, you know, he's one. He can't even talk. Like, he's going to press all kinds of stuff. No, but he's going to press anything. And my niece, who's four, she does the same thing. She's on the iPad all the time. Yeah, and she can read a little bit.
That's it. If it pops up, you want that nice new fairy costume or that.
And it's going to be a picture of the pound coin or whatever that you've been spending, the coins anyway. They're just going to click on it. They click on anything.
Kids don't often have a sense of how much something costs anyway, as well. They're like, it's £2. If I asked my mum for £2 for a drink, she'd probably give it to me.
I mean, some of these kids are like, you know, 12, and I don't believe they didn't know. But
so there are a few things that need to be addressed here. It's not just Apple. Obviously, Apple's just always pulled out because it sells so many devices. But I think that over the next few months, we're going to see companies like Apple, like Google, like Amazon, having to put in basically parental lock restrictions in a way that specifically addresses the App Store. Because a lot of these things are already in place, but they don't always cover every action related to spending.
It has to be as soon as they download the game as well. I mean, parents... I mean, obviously some part comes down to parental control.
Yeah.
If they're saying, yes, I'll download this app for you, I'll allow it.
It
and
needs a separate password.
Them straight away to put a password in for in-app purchases.
It needs a separate password. You need to be able to, because all in-app payments, at least in Apple's world, are standardized. You pay them through the app. Apple, the App Store, the app, the device, it knows that an in-app payment is an in-app payment. And so it should not be very difficult to assign a separate restriction specifically for that.
That's so cheeky. I feel like they were just like, do you know what, guys? Let's just do it. Let's make that 170 quid and let's just see what happens. And now, like, finally, something's happening.
But if anyone actually buys it, and then they do, and they go, well, okay, I guess we leave it.
Yeah, exactly. Until people start really complaining and making themselves heard.
But it's something to definitely be aware of. If you're giving iPads and tablets and phones and things to your kids, you might want to check that they're aware that an in-app payment is actually not virtual money, but it's your bank account.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised on this week's podcast, why not tell us about them? The team is waiting for your comment at facebook.com/wiredUK.
Okay, let's move to our next segment. Second time this one has appeared. This is... Ew! This is the segment where we discuss some of the more disgusting things in the world. Body parts, decapitations...
Oozing,
fluids, you name it, we've got it. And this week, Ian, we're talking about the artist who has collected DNA from discarded hair and nails and 3D printed the owner's face.
Yes.
If anything qualified for ew, it's this one.
Yes. This is an artist, Heather Dewey Hagsbord, who has a show in New York called In Stranger Visions, which... in her own words, calls attention to the impulse towards genetic determinism and the potential for a culture of genetic surveillance. And what that actually means is that she's been going around
picking hair off the street.
Yes, she's been going around New York picking up stray bits of gum and hair and cigarette butts and stuff like that. Bits of things that have stray bits of DNA on them. And then she's been sequencing the genetic code and looking for specific parts of that called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, which are genetic markers that we know are associated with certain physical characteristics, which can be male pattern baldness to heart disease to anything. But the sort of around 50 that she actually looks at are pretty basic ones. They're doing stuff like gender, race, eye color, hair color, freckles, lighter or darker skin, certain facial features like nose width, distance in the eyes, all that kind of stuff. It's very basic. Which she then has a computer program that she created herself. She puts all the stuff in there and it creates a 3D model in the computer that she can kind of like gaze at longingly as long as she wants to.
And then 3D print it.
And 3D prints it and like mounts them on the wall. Yes.
I wonder if she should team up with those people we talked about earlier and have them glow.
That would be Imagine
would
how
great if you could
3D print a face but have the eyes glow.
Yes.
I'd love that. I would do that with my cat when he dies. If he dies.
Get him taxidermied and yeah.
I'm still hoping to make him live forever.
Just dip him in some.
I feel like there's some kind of privacy issue in here. You know, my DNA, I don't know about you, but it's quite personal to me. It feels pretty intimate.
That's exactly her point, is that as we go through life, you know, we're walking on the street, we're sitting in the office, whatever, we shed skin flakes and hair and stuff without even thinking about it. We can't help doing that because that's what animals and humans do.
Yeah.
And we just trust that people like her aren't going to, like, scrape well, the skin.
People like her,
sidewalk.
She's just doing it for art, and creepy art. Yeah. But, you know, the idea is that, you know... someone wants to find out if you've been somewhere, they can find out from scraping up stuff around the edges in the dust and stuff. It's quite creepy.
I'm really looking forward to the day that someone goes into her gallery and just sees their face.
Yeah, no one's done it yet, but I hope someone does.
What's the actual reason for this?
That is
the reason.
Yeah, it's to kind of illuminate the idea of we're moving towards a future where you will be able to be tracked genetically.
Oh, art.
Yes.
You and your... things.
Yeah. Admittedly, the resemblances aren't amazing at the moment because she describes it as more like cousins than spitting image because these genetic markers they're vague. You know, the whole field of finding out what genetic things make you look the way you do is still quite basic.
She can't really know unless she's actually been stalking people and picking up their hair and gum. How does she know how far a distance they are from the real thing?
Been doing that?
Could you print other body parts? Does it have to be a face?
I think you could, but the face is most interesting because it's something we'd recognise. I mean, I imagine most...
Speak for yourself, Chief.
I mean, I'm not great at recognising differences between hands. I mean, if you show me like three different hands and ask me who they came from, I couldn't say, but I could recognise someone's face.
Yeah.
Pretty.
So
apparently ears are very telling in criminal cases, like when it's identifying whether somebody has made themselves look different in order to escape detection.
Yeah.
Apparently the ears are a dead giveaway.
The shape taping of the ears. Back or?
No. Like,
they just never bother changing.
Because you can change eye colour, you can do stuff to your face, you can dye your hair, you can have plastic surgery and things like that. But the ears are always a dead giveaway.
I would never think to hide my ears.
No.
I'd change them.
Well, next time you do a crime, Ian, just be sure to go Van Gogh on your... on your lobes.
The Wired.co.uk podcast comes to you every Friday from London, and our back catalogue is available on iTunes or by visiting wired.co.uk/podcast.
Last story we're going to get to. This is a delve into the segment known as Sex Watch. Now, Sex Watch isn't just about sex, reproduction, and things like that, which we talk about quite a lot on this podcast. This is also gender. And this week, there was a study that we covered that suggested that women undervalue themselves when working with men. Now, Liat, you're a woman.
I am a woman.
You're working with me.
What?
I'm a man.
Yeah.
Do you feel undervalued? I know. Do you feel undervalued?
It's not about you're putting it. It's not like I think... you undervalue me. I undervalue myself, and I can absolutely relate to this study.
Really?
It was a little bit worrying. This is exactly how I am, and actually a few people on Twitter talking about it, I kind of felt a little bit at ease that I'm not the only one. I wouldn't specifically say that it is around men. I think I probably do it just in general, but the elements of the study I'll tell you about sound very familiar to me. So basically, it's this team from University of Massachusetts, team of psychologists, and they got together a group of men and women, told them they'd be working on a project with a member of the opposite sex. Now, they wouldn't actually meet the person; they'd be sent emails and memos. But they were told that at the end, the best of both their work would be pulled together, presented, and rated. Key to this was that they were given information about their role, that, you know, it's supposed to be a work environment, and the role was managing supervisor at an investment company, which also included kind of demographics on the type of person that usually filled this role. And surprise, surprise, it was like 86% male dominant role. So the feedback that they would get from the work once their project, they'd submitted their work and it had been pulled together, was always positive. And half the group got kind of very general group feedback, and half got individual feedback. They were then asked to fill out a questionnaire, say, you know, how well they thought they'd done, how well they thought their partner done. And time and time again, women who were given group feedback, which was vague, rated themselves lower than their male partner over and over again. When the study was replicated with partners of the same sex, women no longer undervalued themselves, and they actually rated themselves higher than the other person. And it basically, they're showing that unless you have kind of specific individual feedback saying, you've done a good job because of this, this, and this, the assumption is that good work has to be down to my partner. when there is a male partner involved. They even had another scenario where they were told that half the work submitted would be from them and half would be from their partner. So, you know, the logic is, if I get good, you know, if it comes back with great feedback, I have done a good job because it was half my work. But even then, if they got general feedback, women still undervalued themselves. And it's just kind of astonishing. It's kind of, this is something I can definitely relate to. And I think it's a huge problem. Obviously, teamwork is, you know, in every job and professional job, and obviously a lot of roles, professional job roles, are male dominant. You basically undermining your own ability to advance your career. And there's been loads of related studies about, you know, women, people prefer women to be modest in, you know, when they're giving a lecture or where they're instructing them or something, don't like dominant women, they listen more to modest women. There's been quite a few studies. And it's kind of infuriating because you think at every level there is a bias. There's studies about people marking CVs, and if it's a female rather than a male, they're less likely to hire them. And it's just...
So this was an American study, and it was surveying American workplaces and women and men. I would be very interested to see how this study would come out in other parts of the world. In Japan, I think it would be... probably along these lines, but possibly even more significantly.
I think, it must be
more extreme.
Must be more severe in some places. Like gender roles in other parts of the world are much more defined. You know, we think I'm not all that modest, but, you know, I probably am, like, you know, try and be, stay things nice and politely.
I think even here the results might be slightly different because, you know, there's a stereotype of English people being quite reserved and quite modest.
Says who?
Well, that's a stereotype. I'm not saying it's always true, but it's a stereotype, but... yeah, but it's still definitely...
One of the studies I came across that was interesting was that it's not women being modest, but actually kind of gets them further because people listen to them more. I don't know if that's like been replicated in a lot of studies, but yeah, you know, it's just bad news.
Well, I think you're both brilliant, so, you know, and I think I'm brilliant too.
Yeah.
And
I think you're both brilliant.
We think you're brilliant
upstairs. You know, there's no modesty here. We're a team. I think we're all equally brilliant. So.
It happens in loads of jobs, though, anyway, that people, you know, in big companies, people don't take the time to pat someone on the back. So it's probably...
Nothing says well done than a firm, open-palmed pat on the behind.
And no further.
On the behind.
And no further.
Just thought I'd throw that one out there. It's my management style, isn't it? Yeah, it's not really.
You pat Ian's butt and mine.
I'm just a, you know, committed...
Just a touchy guy.
...butt patter. You know, I'm just... nothing says well done like a nice squeeze. Let's end the show, shall we?
Let's end it.
Before HR comes down and thinks that I'm being serious. Ian, how can people get in touch?
Several ways. We have our Twitter account, which is @YHUK. We have the Facebook page, which was mentioned earlier. It's @YHUK. There's also the email at podcast@wired.co.uk, which please send us your thoughts. We'd love to hear them.
We will open our eyes, gaze at your words, and think, by Jove, what an insightful gentleman or lady has sent that.
Or other,
yeah.
That's true. Okay, anyway, we're going. I'm going to Amsterdam. Liv and I will be back on the show next week. See you then.
Bye.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.